This is Redefining the Counterculture on Witten Radio. Make sure to check out our website at wittenradio.com.
Hey guys, you're listening to another episode of Redefining the Counterculture right here on Witten Radio. Today we've got a special guest for you. We're joined by actor Bill Oberst Jr. Bill, how's it going?
Walter, how you doing, man? Tell me, what you Redefining the Counterculture, is that the title of your program?
That is, yes, sir.
I'm interested in that. What do you mean by that?
Basically, when I started Witten Radio back in 2009, I saw how the media had, like, this really, really, negative effect on people. It's still this way. The way that, stories are told, information's left out, people aren't, like, informed of, the correct accounts of different things. And so when I started this podcast and this blog, I really wanted to step out and do something different. And I was going over show names just in my head, and I kept seeing culture. And so I looked up culture, kind of got the definition of that, and then I also looked up counterculture. And the definition of counterculture is it's like a set of values or things that are at a specific time counteractive to counter to whatever, like, the culture is. For instance, if the culture is to take selfies and be of yourself and be, like, self-absorbed, the counterculture of that would be to not be self-absorbed and to actively try to be, like, a better person and to think of, like, your fellow man. And so I thought about, what if I could help to redefine the counterculture? Because the counterculture is, like, whatever, thing or things that isn't popular, So, whatever is not popular at the time, it would be considered, like, the counterculture. And so I was like, what if I could redefine that and make it cool, make it the norm, make it, make things better, so to speak. And so that's how Redefining the Counterculture was born.
I applaud you for that. And that's something that I'm hyper aware of, being in entertainment, particularly in independent film, is constantly this tension between what are perceived as the tide of popular culture, because that's the way the money always wants to go, like any other business. It's about money.
Absolutely.
And then there are artistic ideas behind films, and actors and producers, of course, are notoriously hard on our sleeve people. We generally want to make the world a more empathetic, inclusive, and kinder place. And you have to run along the current of popular culture and try to skirt along the edge of it. Anyway, I thank you for explaining that. I found it very interesting.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, I guess that's, like, the first time that I've really ever explained it to anybody. So I'm glad that you asked, because I was able to tell the story behind it. Because a lot of people, they're like, oh, that's kind of a weird, that's a weird name for a show, or it's a cool name, but they don't ever try to, delve into its meaning. So it's cool to be able to share it with somebody and to tell kind of what led to its creation. So.
Well, I come from a world of misfits. Myself, I'm a misfit. I work in a genre which generally is run by and financed by misfits. And I'm here to talk to you about a movie about Sasquatch, who, if they exist, would be like the ultimate cultural outcast. So it's good.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I actually wanted – that kind of leads into my first question, but I wanted to ask you, what got you involved in acting? Was acting something that, you always knew you wanted to do?
People made fun of me, and I wanted them to like me. And I had to find some way that people would like me. Like all humans, nobody likes to be mocked and ridiculed. And I was different in just about every way a kid could be different. I was a fat kid, the ugly kid, the smart kid, and the sissy kid, a real geek. And knew all the answers in Sunday school and was very unattractive because of acne, and also had an unusual face, which wasn't considered handsome. So, yeah, for all those reasons, it led me to discover a great truth, and that was if you entertain people, they will not hit you. And not only will they not hit you, but they will like you if you perform to them like a performing monkey. So from the time of court jesters and kings, that's the bargain that freaks make with society is we will entertain you if you don't make fun of us. That's the bargain. If you scratch actors and performers, you're usually fine that.
Absolutely.
And freaks and misfits know how to entertain instinctively, because when you're made fun of and you're picked on a lot, you become extremely aware of the signals that a person's about to do that, and thus you become a very keen observer of human nature. And that's what acting is observing human nature to the point that you can make a non-real person believable through your portrayal by giving them the attributes that you've seen from real people.
Yep, that is correct. That is 100% correct. So you've amassed this amazing career as an actor, and you're most notable for your roles in horror. That genre, like you said, it's kind of a misfit genre because not all people like horror, but there's a large amount of people that do. What kind of draws you to that genre? Do you like playing other roles outside of horror roles?
I do, and generally, if I am given my choice, I'll always play the wounded monster, and that can be played in drama or in horror, metaphorically or literally, and that is the person who becomes a monster or a monstrous through things that are outside of their control, the way that they look or the way that they're treated or the circumstances around them. My personal belief is that we're all little Victor Frankensteins, and we all have the capability to create monsters, and we do it every day without realizing it. I tell kids this when I speak in schools. Be really, really careful of your cruelty. I know you want to be cruel. It's natural for humans to want to mock other humans. Be real careful with that stuff because it's toxic, and you will create horrible consequences for society. So that's why I'm into it artistically, because horror is the purest expression of that genre. You can do it in other genres too, but I generally end up playing villains, and that matches my face.
Absolutely. When you first, I guess because you have such a lengthy body of work, when you first started, acting and you were casted, I guess, in your first, horror role, was it hard for you to, I guess, walk that out and to get into character? Because I know that along with what you do comes a certain amount of typecasting. Was that something that you had to overcome? Did it ever bother you at any point?
Yeah, sure it did. I did theater for 16 years, and I did generally comedy, and so I started playing around in comedy and historical characters, straight stuff. And when I started playing around with film, I noticed that I was only getting cast for darker and darker characters, and the darker the character, the more likely I'd be cast. So I had to make my peace with it. I personally am a follower of Jesus, and so I had to get straight in my own head, what are my boundaries? What do I want to play? Do I want to play darkness? Do I want to bring this darkness into the world and bring it to life? And if so, why? What are my reasons for that? What's my rationale? What boundaries, if any, do I have? So, yeah, you have to work out all of that stuff if you're going to take it seriously. Walter, people hear this stuff. People hear actors talk like this, and they're like, dear God, if you work at CVS and you sell pens, you just go in and you sell pens. That's what you do. So why do you actors have to be so philosophical? And it's because we don't have anything to offer except what's inside us. And the camera looks at your eyes, and the camera knows if you're being truthful. And you don't work if you're not truthful. So in order to be truthful, unless you're extremely beautiful and people just want to look at your body or something, you've really got to get into your head and understand why you're doing this. So then the camera will see that truth in your eyes. And in this movie, Hunting Grounds, that's coming out in February, I played a character who's going out into the woods to look for something, and instead he finds a Sasquatch. And so there's a lot of fear involved there. And that was fun to do because fear is not an emotion that I'm usually asked to play. Usually I'm the one causing the fear.
Absolutely. I want to talk about your film, Hunting Ground, because it's amazing. I did see a screener for it. And I wouldn't say that I'm a huge horror fan, but when I saw this film, I was like, man, I've got to interview Bill. And I remember asking Clint and Ashley, you know, could they help set this up? Because, you know, I think they were offering interviews with the director only, and they said, well, we'll have to check with Bill to see. But something about your character in the film really, really drew me in. But before I talk about the film, I want to talk about your faith because, you know, I had no idea that you were a man of faith, that you, you know, you believe in Jesus Christ. And, you know, you were asking me about my show name, and that was part of it as well, you know, because I'm a believer. And, as you know, there's a lot of evil in the world, and it's just culture has kind of taken what's good and called it bad, and what's bad, they've called it good. And so part of my show name is, you know, I want to help take back, you know, and help make the world a better place, you know, make things good again. And so that kind of feeds into my title as well. But you yourself as a Christian, do you ever find it hard to, I guess, walk the line between being, you know, a man of faith and, you know, reconciling yourself with, like, the roles that you take? Because I know that, you know, Hollywood isn't all, you know, yellow brick roads. There are some, you know, dark parts of, you know, working in Hollywood, working in the entertainment industry. Do you ever have that internal conflict that you deal with? And if so, how do you deal with it?
I'll answer that two ways. One, I believe that there's such a thing as evil and that it can be embodied in a human being. I actually believe in a literal devil. I believe that there's a spiritual warfare going on. And so because of that, if I'm going to play the dark side, the devil, if I'm called to do that, I'm going to play it realistically and for real, because I believe it is for real and serious. So I see it as almost a mission, you know. I want people to be so unnerved by what they see when I do a portrayal like that. I want them to feel so uncomfortable that something in their soul says, this is real. There are real things like this in the world. So in that way, I'm trying to play the darkness to point toward the light, because I don't get the light roles. You know, nobody hires me to play the good people. And then two, and this I think is really important for people who consider themselves Christians and, you know, are down in Hollywood to understand. If it were not for Christians, everybody would follow Jesus. Because Jesus is great. I've been in love with him since I was a kid, since I first found out about him. It's Christians that turn people away, you know, because we're human and because we take the focus off him and we put the focus on ourselves and our own rules, just as happened when he was walking the earth. So I got people, friends of every faith and of no faith, and I've never once had any one of them say, boy, I really don't like Jesus. And it's just the opposite. It's, you know, really, Jesus said that? What do you mean by that? You know, Jesus is all right with everybody, but it's the damn Christians that give him a bad name.
Right.
Excuse my French.
True.
As my mother used to say, excuse my French. So that's why, you know, I never preach to anybody, but I just tell them that I'm a Jesus freak, and I love him, and I know that there's evil in the world, too, and if I get called upon to play evil, I want to play the evil so strongly that people are drawn to think if there might be light as well.
Absolutely. That's a good, I mean, that is a good stance to have, because somebody actually, you know, the other day, they said, you know, you don't have to walk around with this sign on that says, hey, you know, like, you know, I'm for Jesus or I love Jesus. I mean, you can, that's your prerogative, but people mostly watch your life. They watch what you do, how you treat people, and so on and so forth. So I guess the biggest, you know, testimony or, you know, compliment that you can give to Jesus is just to, you know, to walk the best life that you can and to treat others with respect. Like you said, we all have, you know, that Dr. Victor Frankenstein in us, you know, but it's up to us to, you know, to keep him at bay. You know, we can become monsters, each and every one of us, with the way that we treat people, you know. And so that was something great that you hit on earlier.
Just to show unconditional love, that's a life's work by itself. It's all about love. If you don't have love, I mean, you know, like the Corinthians says, if you don't have love, nothing else matters, nothing.
Exactly. That is right. And
that's
the
man who kills people for a living, generally. So, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But they all deserve it, Walter. I don't kill anybody who doesn't deserve it, you know.
So true, so true. So, let's talk about your newest film, Hunting Grounds. Man, it's amazing. It is, I didn't think I'd like it, but it's so good. It's shot so well. The story is really good. What was it like for you, you know, working on this film? Do you remember initially getting the script and kind of what it was like auditioning for the role?
I do. John Portanova offered me the role because he'd seen some of my other work, and he works with a group called the October People, and they make horror the old way, which was to have characters that people would care about, and then to get into some spookiness or creepiness. There's another school of horror that says, I want my monster early, and I want to be scared in the first minute. And so those are never the twain shall meet, but they make movies for the people who want to get interested in the characters and then have a little spookiness come in, too. So I dug that. I really liked the idea that he treated the Sasquatch as if they were actual animals who had a family structure, and he treated them as if they were real, not just monsters. And then lastly, I love his sense of history because my character in there is named Bauman, and that's based on a hunter who encountered in the late 1800s something which we would today call a Sasquatch. And Teddy Roosevelt wrote about him in his memoirs in 1901. And I thought, wow, and I knew this because as a kid I read a lot about Bigfoot, and I thought, that's so cool. So
yeah,
John treated the Sasquatch not as monsters, but as if they were actually undiscovered creatures.
Wow. Yeah, it was so, so well done. And what I like about it is you're so right. You know, it's written from a standpoint that you really care about, you know, the people in this film. Like, you know, it's a horror film, and so obviously, you know, many of the characters would be expendable, but, you know, you feel a sense of connection with the characters, and that's something that, you know, a lot of horror movies today are lacking. You know, the reason why I stopped watching a lot of horror is because today a lot of horror films are just blood and gore. The story, you know, is lacking. But this one, it draws you in right from the opening scene, and it just kind of keeps you there. I mean, it's like you said, it's all done, you know, with a sense of the real world at heart, you know. And I had no idea about, you know, your character's name, the significance behind it. That's incredible. He really did his homework.
You know, as interesting to me is the question of, do Sasquatch exist? On which I'm undecided. It's interesting is that question is the question of, why do we want them to exist? Because most people do, and survey after survey you'll find people, they really want Sasquatch to exist. They want the Loch Ness Monster to exist. They want there to be mysteries in the earth and things we haven't discovered yet. And why is that? And where does that desire, that yearning desire come from for the story not to be finished, for us not to know everything? I find that very fascinating psychologically.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, there's definitely a mystery to this earth, to this world. I mean, there, you know, just scientifically speaking, there are, you know, parts of the ocean that we'll never see because the depth is so great. There's, you know, parts of, you know, our universe, our galaxy that, you know, we may or may not be able to, you know, ever reach. And so, you know, this quest for, you know, Sasquatch, the Loch Ness Monster, you know, all this stuff, you know, these are, you know, real questions that people have and mysteries that we may never know. But I think that mystery, I think it kind of unifies us in a way, and it just shows that, you know, we all come from, you know, the same creator. You know, we have, you know, for instance, we're from two different backgrounds, like you and I, but this, the commonality of, you know, this possibly mythical creature is something that we can connect on and agree with. And so, I mean, I think it's amazing because it's those questions that, you know, really show how much alike we are as humans. despite, you know, differences in our backstories.
Yeah, I fully agree, and horror is a genre that can explore that. You know, economically, you may be interested to know this, horror has the highest return on investment. It's called ROI in the business.
Wow.
So if you're going to invest in a movie, horror is the safest bet, and very, very close behind that is family values movies.
Really?
So those are the two, and they both deal with very primal needs that people have, you know, to be frightened and to face death, and I guess they're both in some way about facing death. So, but I find it very interesting too that those two are the highest return on investment. They're the ones that you can almost guarantee, and they both do well internationally because both faith and fear speak a universal language.
That is correct. That is correct. Yeah, because I'm just thinking, you know, 2 summers ago, there was a film called War Room, and it did really well. It was like, yeah, I did as well. It was number one at the box office during the summer, where, you know, superhero films usually reign supreme. And so you're so right. I mean, it's like those are two things that people, you know, people want to see. You know, I never thought of that before, and I didn't know the stats on it, but yeah, you're so right.
So I appreciate this conversation because if people do come to Hunting Ground, they won't turn it on and expect there to be blood spattering the screen in the first 10 seconds. And that it helps to have an expectation. With indie films, you don't get that sometimes because, you know, I work primarily in independent films. They don't have the promotional budget that the big studio films do. And so people come to them and they have no idea. All they have is a title and a box to go by. So it helps for them to have a little expectation of what to expect when they come to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're so right. With indie films, what do you like most about acting in indie films? Because I know that you've done, you know, you've got a wide body of, you've done, you know, stage, and then you've done television, of course. With indie film, what are some things that you enjoy the most about it?
What I like most about indie films is they don't have to be made in Hollywood anymore. It used to be the case, but digital changed all that. So you can have a guy in Bangkok who has a really good idea for a movie, and he can get in touch with a guy in Dallas who will shoot it for him, and they might end up shooting it in Austria. And I love that communal world collaboration that you can get. The special effects might be done by somebody who's in mainland China or in Alaska. You know, it's a team film. It's a team effort anyway. But with indie films, you get people who don't have a lot of money, but who have a lot of passion, and they join up with other people who are the same way. And that's how you get enough money to make your movie and plenty of passion. I love that idea. I think that we're citizens of the world first, and that's really important. And so in this business, you're constantly reminded of that because we deal with people all over the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wanted to talk to you. I know that there's, you know, I'm not an actor, but I've heard from other actors that, you know, there's this distinctiveness between stage, television, and film. Out of the three vehicles, what would you say do you enjoy the most? Do you enjoy television work?
Stage. And it's because of the immediacy. You get an immediate feedback from the audience, and it becomes more like a date. And you can feel your collective date is sitting out there in the dark, and you can feel whether they're liking what you're doing, whether you're going in the same place, whether you need to modify or make a little change, just like being on a blind date. Whereas film is more like being with a hungry, voracious lover who knows exactly what they want, and you damn well better give it to them. So there's a lot to remember in film. You know, you've got the technical part of your brain going. Am I standing in the right place? Am I hitting my light? Is my eye line right? You know, am I remembering to not blink when I want to look powerful and to blink when I want to look weak, and so forth and so forth. And then at the same time, you've got your acting stuff going. And the same with television. Television usually you shoot a lot quicker than you do on a big budget film. So it's the speed with which you've got to get in, and you've got to be prepared and have your stuff together.
Absolutely.
So each one has its own challenges, and you have to dial it down when the camera's right up on you. stuff that you do on stage would look ridiculous. But then the opposite is true. I've got performances this weekend. I got 4 shows at a theater in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, a pretty big theater. And if I do the same stuff that I do on television, it's stuck in a register. You've got to be a little bigger, so.
Absolutely.
You feel where you are. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've heard that before. You've got to act big for stage. With stage, though, is it? I would imagine that there's probably a little bit more of a demand, I would think, because you know everything's in real time, and there really are no do-overs in theater, are there?
That's right. No, there aren't, and it's good training for independent film because in independent film, a lot of times you don't get do-overs. You get just a couple of takes, and you got to move on. Because it's so short. So doing stage is a really good. And it's also good to have things go wrong on stage, because if you do enough stage, you're going to grab a hold of the door, and the door will fall out of its frame, and you'll go on stage with your pants unzipped, or you know your wig will slip, or you're going to drop a glass of water. And you get used to things happening and to adapting to them, and then that really, really helps you on set, because then you don't freak if everything doesn't work exactly the way it did in rehearsal.
Absolutely, absolutely. So essentially, stage teaches you how to adjust to things on the fly and how to adapt to, I guess, your surroundings a lot better.
That's true. Yes, and a lot of times if they're doing a reaction shot in you on film, particularly independent film, the other actor that you're acting with is not there because they may be off doing another scene with another camera. So you got to have an emotional memory built in of how you would respond to that person if they were there. And the stage helps you do that because a lot of times when you're on stage, if you're with another actor, they may or may not be there for you. They may be doing a laundry list in their head.
Absolutely.
So you got to do it yourself. Yeah.
Absolutely. Bill, what would you say is like the biggest misconception about being an actor? Recently had an interview with Brooke Lewis last week, and she was saying
she's great.
Yeah, she was a pistol, and she really set the show on fire. She said some really eye-opening things, and one of the things she said was that you know, people that are not in the entertainment industry feel like, you know, Hollywood is just this big, you know, fairy tale, and, you know, you make one television show appearance or one film appearance and, you know, you're a millionaire and, you know, you're living in the hills and all this. And she said, no, there's real work that goes into, you know, this craft and making it as an actor or an actress. And then yesterday I read an article by Denzel Washington, and he, you know, was saying, you know, something similar. He said, you know, of course it's not the same as, you know, working, you know, like a menial job as, you know, a trash collector or something like that. But, you know, there is, you know, work that goes into the craft, and a lot of times people don't know that. You yourself, what would you say, I guess, is like the biggest misconception that people have about the world of acting that you run across?
That it's in some way connected with the world of glamour. They're not actually connected. They get temporarily connected because people like it, because we have this need to have kings and queens and hierarchies and people who we call celebrities. None of that's real. It's not real. And for the most part, the gowns are rented. They all have to be returned afterwards. The so-called red carpet is a piece of industrial carpet that you rent along with the backdrop and the lights. It's all created. It's not real. None of it is real. The only thing that's real is the performances that people are giving. The rest is bullshit. And we know it's bullshit because we're in the business. And I don't like the fact that people, if they meet an actor, they will immediately say, oh, what have you been in that I might have seen? So that they can rank them. Are you a good actor or a bad actor? You're a good actor. You've been in stuff I've seen. You're a bad actor if you haven't.
Wow.
Whereas actually the profession's not at all about that. It's not about that at all. There are plenty of people who make their living as an actor that you never heard of and you never will. You know, for most people, I'm one of them. Most people have never heard of me. But people within a specific genre might have heard of what I do. But if I give a performance that helps move a person towards empathy or towards thinking about what it's like to be somebody else, That's it. That's the meaning. That's the point. Not our so-called red carpet or any of the glamour. Here's something for people to think about. Anytime you see Hollywood excitement, quote-unquote, on screen, notice that it's edited really quick, a lot of quick shots. There's always music behind it. Why is this? It's because it's not real. And in order to make it real, you've got to emotionally manipulate with the music and with the images, because you're emotionally manipulating people into believing that this profession is associated with excitement and glamour. And it's not. But I understand why they do that, because it makes people want to see the movies. I don't know if they'd want to come if they, you know, if they thought that acting was a profession kind of like building a house. So I don't know. I'm not a very good celebrity, Walter. I'm not good at this. I'm not a good celebrity.
Hey, it's quite all right. I like it. I like, you know, your honesty and your openness. I mean, I think that, you know, that's commendable, because you're right. I mean, it is a lot of it is, yeah, it's made up, just point blank. But you know, the average, you know, moviegoer, or you know, just the average American or person just doesn't know. I mean, you don't know that, and so it's always interesting to get, you know, an actor or an actress's take on, you know, the world that they, you know, partake in, and you know what it, you know what it means to them at the end of the day. Because at the end of the day, it's, you know, to you it's just a job. It's, you know, it's your career. But
if I got to do a red carpet, then what I'm saying to my family is I got to go to work now.
Right.
Because I'm going to work. I'm on elevator shoes because I'm too short. And you got to be as tall as the woman you're with on the red carpet always. So I wear the Tom Cruise lifts. They'll get you up 4 inches. So when I got to do a red carpet, if I think it's like to hurt my feet too much, I do those. And oh my God, the women, the shoes that they have to wear. I was beside a really well-known actress on a red carpet, who won't embarrass with a name, but standing beside her with me and two other people, everybody wants to be seen with her. And she leans over and she says to all of us, "Guys, this is the last shot. My feet are killing me."
Wow.
And we get off the red carpet and she pulls off the heels and she steps back behind the backdrop and she says, "Expletive, deleted, expletive, deleted. I hate these expletive, deleted shoes." This is a really famous woman who you think she'd be like, "Oh, I love being glamorous and I love waltzing through." No, her feet hurt, and I really like that.
Wow. See, this is the stuff we don't know. Like, you just don't know. I mean, that's awesome. I mean, it's not awesome that happened to her, but it's just...
It doesn't sell. And it doesn't help sell magazines, and it doesn't help sell movies, because it does away with the illusion and the hierarchy.
Absolutely. I had no idea that you were short. Like, the way that film is shot and even television, I thought you were kind of a tall guy, you know.
We're all short, all decent actors. You don't find many decent actors that are tall. We're all short.
Wow.
My agent also represents Danny Trejo, who's shorter than me, and a couple other actors who, we're all short.
Wow.
We stand on boxes, and so, yeah.
Wow. That is...
We're usually tiny. That's the thing people would generally say when they meet an actor is, "Oh, you're so tiny."
Oh,
I don't know why there's a correlation there. I don't know what that is.
Wow. I did not know that. That is crazy.
I have the body of a 13-year-old girl, and she wants it back. Generally, when I go in for fitting, it's like that's what my size sheet says. It is, these are my sizes, but my frame is extremely thin, and my shoulders are extremely narrow. So medium, I'm going to swim it. It has got to be small, and if you got it, I need small. And there are a lot of actors like that.
Wow. I had no clue.
Yeah, revealing too much here, Walter. But in the movie, in Hunting Grounds, the actor who played the Sasquatch says, was extremely tall, so I'll give him props. There are some really tall guys that do stunts that are, you got to have them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I would imagine the stunt guys, they've got to be pure adrenaline junkies to do what they do because, you know, I've never heard about one getting killed, but I'm sure that there's been a lot of close encounters, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And on independent films, sometimes we're called on to do our own stunts. And, you know, actors who get injured, I've come across that too. Yeah, it's difficult because you want to make everything look easy. You want to make it, you know, like Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk. I remember the first time I saw that, I thought, man, how hard could it be? I could do that. But that's the beauty of a great stunt person is to make it look effortless.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you so this is kind of a weird question. This wasn't a question I planned on asking you, but as an actor, is there a place that you can go to learn how to do stunts? Because I'll just take myself for instance. I wouldn't consider myself athletic at all. And if I were to ever, you know, in a million years get into acting and was called on to do like a film where I was playing like a superhero or a fighter of some sort, where would you learn how to do something like that? Especially if you had no background in it, is there like a school or something you can go to?
You could take classes, yes, but if it's a film of any reputable size, it will have a stunt coordinator.
Oh, okay.
And the stunt coordinator will train you in how to do the stunts and oversee the stunts. I had one where I had to be pulled into a dungeon by chains that were attached to my feet, not wearing anything but dirt. In this dirty dungeon, and so I had a stunt coordinator who spent almost a day teaching us how to do that, the four guys who had to be dragged down by these chains, and made sure that we were safe and whatnot. So, yeah, generally you have somebody there whose job it is to make sure you're safe.
Absolutely. Okay. Wow, that is crazy.
But you can still get hurt. Abraham Lincoln versus Zombies, I did a jump.
Yeah.
A silly thing with a sword, where I'm jumping down to kill the very first zombie, and I hit my knee wrong and slipped on the pad and tore my meniscus, and it still bothers me. On some days, I can still feel it, and I call it my Lincoln leg. Most actors have something like that.
Jesus. Ooh, that sounds painful.
But, you know, that's the business.
Absolutely. Now, this is a question that I did have. You know, you're called upon to do these very, you know, physical roles oftentimes. And would you say, I mean, was Hunting Ground, was it arduous for you to create as an actor? I know, because I know you had some pretty physical roles, scenes. And in the past you've done some very, you know, physical scenes like you just mentioned. Yes, it was.
Because we were filming in Washington State up in the mountains near a ski resort. And so, to hike around there with the pack and do some of the stunts involving the fights with Bigfoot and stuff, you had to be in shape. So, yeah, generally, you know you're going to do a film a few months in advance, or you can, you know, start working out every day and make sure you got your wind and get lumber and loose and, yeah, because, you know, otherwise, yeah, you can get hurt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What is it that you specifically look for in a film, like when you're, I guess, approached about, you know, for a casting call or something? Is there anything particular that you look for in a film as an actor? Because I know, you know, you'd said personally that, you know, you're accustomed to playing these roles of, you know, the villain, but you always look for kind of the redeeming quality in each villain that you play. Is that something that you look for specifically?
Yeah, what my manager looks for specifically is, these are his exact words, if somebody sends a script and they're like, what role do you think would be best for Bill? My manager will reply, and I quote, which role kills the most people? That's the role that's best for Bill.
Oh, wow.
That's because that's the role that's best for him, because generally that's the role that will get the best reviews. If I kill people, I get reviewed well. for me, I'm looking. I don't like a one-dimensional character. You know, if he's going to do something heinous, I want to know that there's some layers there. I particularly really, really love it if the guy that I'm playing is going to do the thing anyway, but he's troubled and conflicted about it, or he feels like he has to do it. That's a very interesting kind of character to play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's because it's almost like you said, spiritual warfare. It's almost like this person is compelled because they're fighting these, you know, internal demons, these things
yes.
inside that they don't like, but they find themselves doing anyway. I think,
that's right.
Yeah.
Yes, and so we are used to separating ourselves into good people and bad people. I'd never do that. I'm a good person. Those people would do that because they're bad people. So I see my job, particularly playing villains, is to blur the line where people think, well, gosh, I can see where that guy could have been me or I could have been him given different circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're so right. There's somebody, she says, I think it's Monique, actually. She says, you know, I'm one beer away from being a drunk driver. I'm one,
mm-hmm.
You know, and basically what she's saying is, you know, like you said, just under various circumstances, like, you know, you could be a completely different person, you know. And so that's true. I mean, you really have to look at that. I mean, and that, I think all of that falls in line with empathy, you know.
Yes, and that's exactly right. We all have crossroads moments in our lives. And a nonverbal example of that, I did an app for Facebook that won an Emmy a few years ago. It's called Take This Lollipop. And people sign on to takethislollipop.com and they see this creepy hacker trying to hack into their profile, and it's me. And they use technology, so he actually hacks into your profile and looks through your pictures. But there's this, it's all nonverbal, 90 seconds, he's trying to get in, and you can see him deciding, do I really want to do this? At one point, he pulls back from the computer, puts his hands behind his head, and rolls his eyes up, and he's thinking, I want to do this, I need to do this, but I'm not sure. Can I not do this? Boom. But then he makes the decision to do it. He's down at the keyboard, and he's typing with fervor and a wildness in his eyes. And that was fun for me to do because I know those moments in my own life. I've been both ways. And I think it's good for us to understand, to be really self-aware, that life is not just a boat you get in that takes you down a tide, that you reach many points where you can either go off a little side eddy or you can keep to the main current. You know, you're steering the ship. And we all have those moments where we make those decisions.
Yeah, you're so right. You're absolutely so right. I've just got two more questions for you, and I thank you so much for your time. My first question is what is the biggest takeaway that you want people to get from your body of work? I mean, it's been amazing speaking with you and just being able to explore, you know, the roles that you've played and kind of like what we were just talking about just now, you know, people have like this duality to them and there isn't just, things aren't just black and white, you know, there are different motivations and factors and circumstances, Pete's situation, but what would you say is the biggest takeaway that you want people to get from your work when people see the work that you do?
Don't judge your book by its cover. And I say that as a person who, both in real life and in films, have been judged by my cover. Oh, you look like this, so you must be like this. It's a devilish thing, man, and it's natural for humans to want to do it. We seem to be hardwired to do it. We look at a person, we immediately judge, you know, boom, here's who they are. Not thinking that if we saw them with a slightly different face, even a slightly different hairstyle, slightly different clothes, and a different situation, we would think that they were a completely different person.
That's right.
You know, that's the thing I'd like people to take away is be really, really careful about how you judge other people and be aware that you're always judging other people. I know I am. I do it all the time, that I have to stop and think, whoa, I just totally summed up who that person was, and I don't know them.
Absolutely. It's so easy to do, you know what I mean? It really is. I mean, and you find yourself doing it, and it's like, when you find yourself, it's like you're you know, I know personally speaking, you know, I find that I'm fairly disappointed in myself, you know, and I usually try to, you know, try to seek forgiveness and not do it again. But it's so easy to do because, you know, we're so driven by, like you said, the outside appearance of what people look like. And sometimes, like, we just don't know. I mean, we'll never know what a person's true intentions and motives are. And so I think it's just best to treat everybody with respect and to just, you know, do your best to understand where people are coming from, you know, and to have grace with people. You know, we all make mistakes. But, you know, your mistakes, your shortcomings, I don't feel, you know, should define you per se. You know, I still feel like, you know, we should have grace with people. And you hit on so many amazing things.
Yeah, we throw people away, don't we? I mean, we decide what they are and we throw them away. And if you throw a person away and they're still alive and on this earth, you have created something very dangerous.
Absolutely.
Very dangerous. When you tell a person you don't matter and they continue to live and walk on this earth, you've created a monster.
That's right.
And
like
become
said,
one at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like what you said earlier. You become that Victor Frankenstein that, you know, you so fear by doing that. And a lot of times we don't realize that we do that, but it's true, we do. Yeah. My last question is I know that your newest film, Hunting Grounds, comes out February 6th, so the Beyond Demand. And I think it has a limited theatrical release, but that's February 6th is the release date on that. What other things, projects are you working on that you can tell us about, and where can our listening audience find out more about you and keep abreast of what you're doing?
Well, they can interact with me on social media. My name is Bill Overs Jr. on all of it. Twitter is probably the way that most people interact nowadays, and I love to hear from people. I'm on Facebook under the name, too. My site is billovers.com. I'm always running on these dual tracks of, like, you know, trying to do things that are spiritually meaningful and then do stuff that makes money, too. Sometimes I'll go together. So, like, for instance, this year I'm going to Germany for German television to play Hitler's SS General Hans Kammler, who was Hitler's top secret weapons guy and who helped him almost get the atomic bomb. And at the same time, I'm developing a one-man show of the Gospel of Mark. So that's the way my life is. I usually have these two sort of dual paths running.
Man.
And I'm developing a one-man show about Ray Bradbury, and I currently tour with a theatrical version of a Ray Bradbury novella called Pillar of Fire. I'm very into Bradbury. I love his ideas that we have more in common than we don't, and that space should be our great, he calls space the great enemy, the one thing that would unify us in a way that war does. And I love that. So as an actor, you know, you got to have a lot of different little pieces always to be able to keep afloat financially. And so, like everybody else, I do a little bit of everything.
Absolutely. Man, that's awesome that you're able to explore such diverse roles. I mean, like you said, you're going from playing, you know, one of Hitler's generals to, you know, exploring the Gospel of Mark. I feel like that's so cool to be able to not put yourself into a box, but to be able to explore multiple things while still being you and still keeping, you know, the things that make you you. That to me is the mark of a true actor. And so, man,
well, you know, I don't matter, and I'm not going to be remembered. Even if you're remembered for a little while, eventually the people who know you die, and they're not remembered, and then you're not remembered. It happens. You walk down the Hollywood Walk of Fame, you look down, you see a star, and you go, who the hell is that? I don't know. But apparently they were really important at the time that star was put down. So that's a really good thing to keep in mind as an actor. It's never about you. You're not going to be remembered, and it doesn't matter. But you might be able to give a performance that keeps on living and keeps on making people aware of what other human beings are like. And that's what's of value. So, yeah, that's what I try to keep in mind. The whole celebrity thing, it's just, it's a dead end. It's, It's a spiritual, physical, and mental dead end, and it leads to a lot of addictive behaviors.
Yeah.
It's a bad thing. It's not a good thing. Don't encourage actors to go on red carpets, people. It's bad for them.
Absolutely. And, Bill, you're so right. I mean, Denzel Washington said something similar a couple weeks back. He's like, you know, this is, you know, we can't take any of this stuff with us. I mean, you'll never see, you know, a U-Haul, you know, going to a cemetery, you know. So it's like we really have to put our treasures, like, where they matter, you know, the way that we treat people, you know, what we leave behind, all of that's important, not the material possessions or fame or wealth that we amass here on Earth. And so that, yeah, you hit on something so, so true, you know. And
My apartment in Hollywood is close to Hollywood Forever Cemetery. And so, I mean, I can walk to Hollywood Forever Cemetery in like 10 minutes. So you walk around Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and there they are. I mean, there's the cream of the crop of early Hollywood is all right there. And you're like, wow, this is Douglas Fairbanks' grave. Here's Mel Blanc's grave, the voice of Bugs Bunny. And on the stone on Mel Blanc's grave, it says, that's all, folks. And,
yeah.
And that's the truth. I mean, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. None of it matters, and nothing is going to last except what you leave behind in the hearts of other people.
That's so true. That's so true. It's a wake-up call for a lot of people, but then for some people, you know, they will never get that lesson. You know, they'll die thinking that, you know, it's all about material wealth or, you know, whatever. And to me, those are lives that are just, those are like the most wasted lives, in my opinion, the ones where, you know, you're like, oh, I'm going to make a bunch of money and, you know, just, you know, that's my whole goal is to make a bunch of money and to be well known and everything. And it's just like, that's, like you said, it's so fleeting because it's like, once you get it, you know, what else is there, you know?
Yeah. And to get in touch with reality, you got to turn off reality TV, ironically, because
yeah.
The stuff we're talking about makes horrible reality TV. It's boring. Nobody wants to watch that. What are they talking about? True meaning? Empathy? I want to see people fight. So, you know, you've got to shut off all of the crap. So I hope that your program continues and continues putting out the message you are. I'm really, really happy to have the chance to talk to you.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, this was, I mean, this really, really made my day. It was such a blessing to talk to you and such an honor, too. I feel like I learned a whole lot, but it was also entertaining. Like, you kept me on my toes. Like, I've laughed, I've cried a little bit, and I've been able to do some self-realization all within this hour. So this has been amazing, and hopefully you guys out there listening, I hope that this was a great takeaway for you as well. You know, it's the whole goal of this podcast. And so, Bill, I just want to say thank you so much. And I'm all out of questions, but I wanted to open the floor to you if there's anything you'd like to say to our listening audience.
For me to say something to your listeners?
Yeah, if there was anything else that you left out that you wanted to say or –
Thank you. Thank you for those of you who have been kind and for those of you who have tried to understand other people who might be different than yourselves. Thank you for doing that. It's appreciated, it's seen, and it matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good takeaway, Bill. That's a very good takeaway. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do this interview with me. I really appreciate it.
Walter, I totally enjoyed it, man. Bless your brother. Hope to talk to you again.
All right. Hope to talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Guys, that was actor Bill Oberst Jr. If you're listening to this on SoundCloud, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. We're also on your iOS device. If you've got an Apple product, you can listen to us on your iPhone, iPad, or Mac computer by downloading the Stitcher Smart Radio app. It's available for free.
in the iTunes store. You can download the apps, search for our show name, Redefining the Counterculture. You'll hear this interview with Bill. We're also on your Android device. If you've got an Android device of any type, you can search for us in the Google Play Music Store. Search for us. Our show name is Redefining the Counterculture. You can download this interview. You can stream it. You can share it with your friends. Subscribe, all free of charge. Lastly, if you've got a Roku player, we're available in the comfort of your home. You can listen to over 200-plus hours of original content and programming from us, all right in the comfort of your home by downloading the iTunes app to your Roku player or your Roku Smart TV. Once you download that app, you can search for our show name within the iTunes store, and it's just Redefining the Counterculture. And our show will be streamed right through your Roku player, right in your home.
This is Redefining the Counterculture on Witten Radio. Make sure to check out our website at wittenradio.com.